And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Green light 3-0 and she's gone!
Welcome to The 3-0 Show. It is September 28th, Thursday. I'm Brittany Rowley here with Eno Saris. Still missing our third wheel, no, our star of the show, Derek Van Riper,
our excellent host.
Yes, for another couple of weeks, so bear with us and all the awkward pauses and transitions. First off, a celebrity among us, those of you who have not really been on Twitter much, get on it, check out the article on Eno Saris. That was just terrific. I mean, it wasn't just terrific because Derek and I were quoted in it. that only added to the value of this piece. But no, it was such a great story, you know, about your journey and the unique role you fill in baseball media and, of course, beer. It was really awesome. I hope you're going to print it out and keep it and do something with it because it was very well done.
The thing that was so awkward about it was leaving the narrative of my life almost in someone else's hands, you know? And I think the lesson for me in that piece actually, it's not a lesson that I've not learned before, but it's something that that really is struck home with me is twofold. One is, we have a large responsibility when we write about players. We're taking their life's narrative into our own hands. And I can see how that can be nerve wracking because he wouldn't even let me give him names to contact. You know, he was researching me without my help. So it was very much like, you know, what Brian Roth was like, who he was going to call and who's going to end up in that piece was nerve wracking to me. And so, you know, that piece over Good Beer Hunting, I thought they did a great job and, you know, I didn't need to be nervous, but I was nervous anyway. And the other thing, just a sort of a sad moment, but I lost my uncle this week, and it was a short but a terrible battle with cancer. And I got the news the same day this piece came out, and just the fact, it's one of those weird things that happens in the cosmos, I think, where just the fact that piece had just come out, and I'm reading about myself in this way and thinking about my uncle. I really put some connections together between him and myself that I hadn't thought of before. He is the most gregarious person in our family. He's the most welcoming. He's the most positive and optimistic person in our family. And he was really sort of important to me when I came to this country and came to my father's family. He's my stepfather. That he was very welcoming, and I didn't realize how much I had in common with him. So it was one of those sort of sad but happy coincidences. So yeah, quite the week.
Yeah, so sorry for your loss, you know. If you're listening to the show, hug your people yeah. For sure. You just never know. But really check out that article if you're interested in a little bit of an unorthodox baseball career or route to a baseball career, if you will. But there is literally nothing unorthodox about this MVP race, especially in the National League as we get into it. Ronald Acuña Jr., as we record this on Thursday, Wednesday night, he swipes two bases, gets himself into the 40-70 club. He's already part of the 40-40 club, only the fifth member in part of that club. And that's a crazy list.
What do you think about them stopping the game to celebrate that? I think it's a little weird considering he already had 40-60. He's already a one person club. Are you going to keep adding like every 10 stolen bases? You got to have another party or whatever. I don't know.
Well, he's not going to get 10 more stolen bases before the season's over. And he didn't celebrate. I was in DC and they didn't stop the game when he hit 40. So I think this was the only time he really celebrated.
And it was in his home park. It was a chance to celebrate his season in his home park. And it wasn't his choice. It was definitely not. I'm not putting it on him. It was the team's choice.
he did take the base out. And so there was going to be a little brief break after he stole second base, puts in the air. And I think the crazy thing, and he, and I got to see him, like I said, in DC last week, he didn't believe really he could get to 40-70. So I think getting to 40-40, you know, hitting the 40th home run, he had the steals well before that, being the only person, as you said, in the 40-50 and 40-60 club. But I don't think a lot of people thought 70 steals was possible to go with 40 home runs. And I don't care how big they make the bases and how they change the rules. It is still really impressive. I'm not one of those people who's going to sit on my front lawn and say, well, somebody could have done it if they had changed the rules, you know, 10, 20 years ago. No, I think this is remarkable. One, that you hit 40 home runs. Two, that you're on base enough to steal 70 bags outside of your home runs. And I know Mookie Betts is having a great year. I know it's going to be a really crazy MVP ballot. I just don't see, you know, how you can't give it to Ronald Acuña when you look at all of the components. And we're not just talking about the 40-70. I'm talking about run score. I'm talking about hits. I'm talking about OPS, like the whole nine yards. What is crazier to me, and no one's going to talk about this, Matt Olson is going to lead baseball in home runs and RBIs. He may finish outside of the top three in MVP voting. In what other universe would that ever happen? We have too much good baseball. We have too many good players.
I think he'll still win. I had a little note in my piece today. One thing I do want to point to is Mike Petriello had a great piece about how Acuña Jr. cut his strikeout rate in half. And that's just another remarkable piece of his season. And the way he did it was improving against fastballs and particularly turning whiffs into fouls, which is kind of cool. Like he's now like a gritty out on top of having plus bat speed that can turn you into 40 homers. He's also improved his plate discipline since he first came in the league. So he's really done that Troutian thing where he's like identified some holes in his game and closed them up, which I think is the superstar gene. You know, it's like the one thing that really separates those top of all times from even the greats in at their time. So, I think Acuña season's one for the ages. And, you know, I am a war guy, and there are some wars, you know, wins above replacement numbers that have bets ahead. But I wanted to point out in my column today that they have them ahead by like decimal points. And war's not really designed to be that way. It's more of a sorting mechanism. There's a thing on the Fangraphs site that even says that, you know, somebody that has 7.2 versus somebody that has 7.1, that's not really a big difference. It's more of a, if you have 7 wins, you're different than a 4-win guy. That's it's more of a sorting mechanism. So when I look at the MVP vote, and I don't have one this year, but if I had the MVP vote, I would look at that as a tie in war, and then I would look beyond war to make my decision. And part of the reason is there's such a wide spread in defensive numbers. There are defensive numbers that say Mookie Betts is the best second baseman in baseball this year defensively. There are numbers that say he's like 21st. There are numbers that say that Acuña Jr. is the 21st best outfielder this year, and there are numbers who say he's 36th. And even the park factors, there are numbers that say that the Atlanta park is the 9th friendliest for hitters, and there are numbers that says 19th. So I kind of sometimes you can adjust the OPS for parks, and I make that's what you do in war. But if you like want to look past war, maybe you look at the raw numbers, because you just look at the raw numbers because you're not entirely sure how the park has contributed to Acuña's offense. And so when I do that, I kind of hew closer to the raw offensive numbers, given that I think it's a tie between Betts and Acuña by wins above replacement.
So who would you give it to?
I give it to Acuña.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, barring anything crazy by Betts here the last, four games, it's just, I don't know how you don't. And what's so interesting, you mentioned that he's just gotten better. It's not just the numbers. His chase rate's way down, strikeouts. I was talking to Ron Washington, who's been in baseball for 50 years, part of Brian Snicker's staff there in Atlanta. And he said he's never seen a more impressive, productive thing for the team than what Acuña has been able to do. And I think you have to look at that and say, yeah, I think he's right, right? This guy is just playing at such a high clip.
Being the best. And I have some ear for narrative too. Like when you have a tie, you can put some narrative in there. And for me, there's a narrative here of being the best hitter on one of maybe the best offense of all time. There's a great Jason Stark column about how the Braves offense might be the best of all time. So And a note in my piece today about why that might be from Matt Olson. But still, just generally, the narrative lines up, the offense is better, and I think it's just an iconic season. So,
yeah. For those who aren't aware, the other four members of the 40-40 club, the highest previously was Alex Rodriguez with 46 steals. So Acuña above and beyond that. Jose Canseco, Barry Bonds, Alfonso Soriano on that list. So a very interesting list. And what's so fascinating, I find, Eno, is, and people had mentioned this as well when I was around the Braves, is how much longer can Acuña steal this clip? Because you look at those names I just mentioned, like A-Rod and Canseco and Bonds. And, you know, as you get older, you have to conserve your energy. Right now, Acuña is 25 years old, so he has the ability to go out and do that. So, you know, when he hits 28, 29, does he say, you know what, 25 steals is good enough for me, right? Does he tail it back? So I think what you're seeing here is not only in an extraordinary season, but the product of age, the product of health. A lot of people in Atlanta feel like the first couple of years Acuña came up, he was so wildly talented that he kind of just got by on talent alone. Then he had so many injuries. He misses the World Series, right, with the knee. He dealt with a hamstring issue. Even last year, his knee wasn't right, so he wasn't really able to run like he could. And people think that kind of drove him, that he actually was like, wait a second here. If I work hard, I can be even better. And he kind of just didn't take it for granted, right? He kind of used that talent and was like, wait, I can be better if I just put the work in. And that's what he's done, and it's scary how good he is and healthy at 25. You're just starting to see it. Because remember a couple of years ago, people were like, who do you want in your organization? You get one player, Acuña or Soto. And there was like a good case for both those guys. And right now, Acuña has is a clear leg up, right, on Soto if you're starting an organization.
Yeah, I mean, it's a testament to some of the things outside of just what you do at the plate. I mean, the added defensive and base running, that's something that Soto's has fallen off for Soto. I mean, he does not look good in the field, and base running, he looks slower than. But one thing that's interesting about Acuña for me is that he's not one of the top 5 or 10 by sprint speed in the big leagues. He's in fact only in the top third of the league in terms of sprint speed. So some of this is willpower, him just wanting to steal those bases. And in terms of efficiency, he's at league average. League average is crazy right now. It's 80%, but he's at like 81%. So, you know, it's like he's right there. It's more about him just wanting to do it and the team being cool with it. So at some point there is a relationship with age and production in terms of power and what the team wants out of you and how healthy you can stay while doing that. Mike Trout stopped stealing bases mostly because he started getting hurt doing it even. The team would rather, hey, we need your slugging. We need you in there to hit those homers a little bit more than we need you running around the bases. So it is a confluence of age, athleticism, and team factors. I do wonder how long he's going to continue to do this, but since he's starting at such a great height, I figure it's like 70 and then it's like 50 and 40 and 30. Like it's like it'll go down. Maybe at some point he'll jump all the way from 30 down to 5 or 10 a year. But that's just how base stealing goes. I don't think he has so much power that I don't think he's going to feel the need to steal bases the same way Ricky did all the way through his career. But it'll be interesting if he's more like Ricky and he just wants to steal bases his whole career. Like, it's not always just how fast you are. It's how you know the game, and how you pick your spots and how much your team lets you be aggressive that way.
What's so stressful, I think, about the MVP voting, whether you have it or not, is that it's 10. Like, I think we can all agree on maybe a top five, but then 5 to 10 is when you're sitting there, and like the years I have MVP, I'm all like, this matters to guys, right? This is in contracts. Guys get bonuses, not just for winning MVP, but I don't think people realize for just being listed in the top 10 lots of times, guys get money. So it's so stressful that 7 to 10 when you're looking at it, because the case can be made for so many guys. But this year in the NL, like the top four guys, as we just mentioned, could be MVPs in almost any other year. Right? You could really.
Matt Olson has 53 homers.
It's incredible, right? Like, and it's incredible that we're sitting here and we're not debating him at all in this conversation. He's not one of these two horses.
Yeah.
And the year Freddie Freeman has had.
I think it's easily the first 2020 season from a first baseman, or first 300 2020 or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. So I hope people realize kind of what a special season that we've seen from some of these guys, and just in general, what a special season we've seen. You know, you look at the rookies of the year, and you look at some of the guys who aren't going to win rookie of the year. Terrific talent. We talked last week about guys who aren't even going to be mentioned in the rookie of the year, who are just really good players. So I think we should look at 2023 as just this like really great season that we enjoyed a lot of really good baseball. Offensively, we enjoyed a lot of really good things.
Yeah.
But then, of course, if you're listening to this and you're a Giants or a Padres fan, and you're like, wasn't that great? which maybe it is, maybe it's not.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I read a really interesting article this morning on The Athletic by Tim Kwamakami saying, you know what? Bob Melvin should be the Giants' next manager. And I thought that was fascinating because I didn't realize Bob Melvin had such ties to the Giants. He played there. He apparently has some in with part of Giants ownership. You know, he obviously does well, really well, with an analytically driven front office. He worked incredibly well with Billy Beane in Oakland. They're very Farhan Zaidi, very analytically driven. I feel like we should mention that Gabe Kapler is signed for next year, and the front office, the ownership has said that they will both be back, Kapler and Zaidi. But I haven't seen this before, Eno, and you're in the Bay Area, and I'm curious if you think that like this should happen at some point, because there is definitely rumblings out of San Diego that Bob Melvin may not return. I don't think it's expected, but it also wouldn't be shocking. So how do you look at this? Could this happen? I know people are upset about Kapler, but they're also upset at Zaidi because the Giants have really failed to improve and have really underwhelmed ever since having that kind of breakout year a couple of years ago. So did you read that article? And is that just like, you know, a wild guess, or is it something that you're like could make sense at some point down the road?
No, it's a great idea, and it's born of the fact that we just had this series between the Giants and Padres. That was wild. I went to the first game, Snell against Webb, as a fan, and there were some comments by Logan Webb afterwards about how the clubhouse wasn't being accountable and, you know, too much like sort of playing cards and being okay with losses in that clubhouse. So an indictment of the clubhouse culture. And then I covered the next day as a writer and asked Gabe Kapler, you know, if there was a relationship between comfort and accountability, if it was okay that they were playing Bob Marley after losses and playing cards, or if there was you had to be uncomfortable with losses. And he kind of, you know, did not like that question and said that, you know, that's not talking about the real issue here. The real issue is process and being ready for games and you know, no one cares what music is played after games. But then in the third game of the series, we saw, that same night, we saw Kapler go out on the field and try to take John Brebbia out of the game. And John Brebbia is joking about, if I hold your arm down long enough so you can't call the reliever in, the umpire is going to come out here and make you go away, and then I can stay on the mound. So Brebbia is joking, and Kapler is smiling, but the situation looked intensely insane to me. That like both people, like that the smile was like a Cheshire Cat, like you just nervous smile. There was actual sort of physicalness between them. There was a physicality between them where they're holding each other's arms. It looked tense. And I've also been around both these teams recently, and all the coaches are on edge. They're paranoid. All of them think they're going to lose their jobs. There was another report today that from on the Padres side saying that Peter Seidler hopes to retain Preller
and Melvin.
Yes. Oh, okay. But I'd have to say that I saw some post-game press conferences from Melvin that were more checked out than I've ever seen. Bob Melvin has coached teams that lost 110 games, and I've never seen him checked out. He said something like, "Well, I guess that's what we're doing now." You know, he had this super weird countenance, and Kapler himself had more of a, like, you guys are like a little bit more of a defensive posture. So paranoia runs deep. There are changes coming. Maybe they both get one more year, but there's some similarity here where the coaches are on the hot seat. Zaidi has not fired a lot of coaches, so he might be able to fire a coach, a manager, and get another one. Preller has fired a ton of managers. I don't know if he can just fire another manager. Yeah, how can you just fire another manager and be like, okay, the sixth one, that's going to be the one that works. So.
Yeah, lucky six in 10 years, too. I don't think people realize. It's not like Preller's been there for 30 years. This is going to be his sixth if they change in 10 years. But Preller is signed very long term because he signed that extension last year, right? Like a 5-year one, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
At the end of the winter. So fascinating. I mean, all things equal, you know, if nobody had guaranteed money, which we know matters to some ownership groups, paying guys, buying out their contracts, would Bob Melvin be a better fit for this Giants organization?
One thing that Kapler does well is he's in lockstep with the front office and sort of creates processes well. He has like a whole spreadsheet that sort of, you know, lays out all the different things that he has a huge coaching staff. He manages a huge coaching staff really well. One thing that I am not getting so much from him is a sort of sense of calm and maybe great communication with the players, because we've had some grumblings, you know, from Giants players about their roles and stuff like that. And we've got Logan Webb speaking out in a way that I have not heard a lot of people speak out in Melvin-led clubhouses before. So I think some of Melvin's strengths are different than Kapler's, and you could see that being a good fit, as in, like, hey, we're going to be a team that does weird things. The A's were a team that, you know, they were pretty platoon heavy. They did different things to get the most out of their roster. Maybe Melvin would be a good match because he would stay in open lines of communication with the players better in some way that, like, made them feel better about these roles they were in. So that's a possibility that would be a good fit. I think the problem in San Diego is Preller's leadership style. It's, you know, he goes around his coaches, he goes around his, you know, his entire organizational tree and just calls people. He calls players directly. He texts players directly. So if you're Josh Hader, there's this big thing about Josh Hader saying, I don't want to go in for 4 outs. Well, if you're Josh Hader and you actually have texted AJ Preller recently and Bob Melvin is telling you something about, you know, hey, we want you in there in the eighth. Does AJ Preller want me in there in the eighth? You know, like, that's what happens with if you start calling people around leadership, then people say, you know, oh, does AJ say this, or are you my boss saying this? You know, and then that creates this confusion in the organization. And that's definitely something that was true when we wrote about AJ 2 years ago and true now in that recent Ken Rosenthal and Dennis Lynn piece about the organizational structure in San Diego.
Yeah, he's such a lightning rod, right? I think certain facets of the organization, he's brilliant. I think people know how much he likes baseball and he loves to win. And I think a lot of GMs, you can't say, are quite as competitive as he is, right? They
good
have a big
eye for
scouting
prospects.
Staff.
He's
yeah,
crazy.
They have huge
found
scouting
a lot of
staff.
Guys.
People that work under him on the scouting side think that he's collaborative and he wants to hear everyone's opinions, and maybe he trusts them, maybe he doesn't, but he makes
and
you feel like you're important. Yes.
Yeah.
But then the people who work more on the baseball on field side, and totally
analytics.
Different story, right?
Yeah.
Totally different story. So it's so fascinating to me. Like, if they're going to keep Preller and they're going to keep Melvin, do they have to add a layer between them? Do they have to add a buffer? Do they have to put someone above AJ? Right? Like, what, I don't know, but it seems like the way this structure has gone, and as you mentioned, the terrific Ken Rosenthal, Dennis Lynn piece on this recently on The Athletic, it said it just can't be fixed, this relationship between the two of these guys. And listen, we're all adults. He's not going to change the way, no one's going to fundamentally change at this stage of their lives. So how do you, if you keep both those men and run it back, and the Padres are playing very well right now, as we record this, they're like clinging to a
best team in baseball in September.
Yeah. You kind of have seen, oh my God, they were going to be really good if they had maybe done this in August. You know, they're just too late. They're going to be eliminated if like three things happen tonight, one of three. But they did finally win in extra innings. So they got that going. But you look at the team and you're like, you can run it back, but you still need to make a few tweaks here and there. And one of their guys in their ownership group, or I think it was maybe their CEO, said on a radio station in San Diego, like, we're going to audit, we're going to look at this organization. So maybe they do bring everyone back and they add a piece here and there, they add a buffer. You know, they do something that changes.
But if AJ's at the top, the field staff is just, the hope I had was that he would trust Melvin, you know, and let Melvin lead the field staff. But if he doesn't trust Melvin, who's he going to trust? You know, like if he's going to go around Melvin, then who's he not going to go around? You know, is he going to put Buck in there and not go around Buck? I mean, maybe, but you know, is Buck available? I don't know.
But is Buck any better than Bob Melvin? Like, I think Buck's a little less inclined to listen to the analytics. That's been part of the pushback of him in New York was, you know, he thought he'd have a little more control than he did.
Well, maybe, right. And is Buck going to sign up for that again? Like, you know, he thought he'd have more control than he did. And then he went there and he's like, oh, okay. The analytics guys, at least going to San Diego, maybe the analytics guys wouldn't have as much control, but AJ would. So does he really want a GM telling his players what drills to do in the field? You know, that's going to annoy any manager.
Yeah, exactly. It's just not a good management style, whether you're working in an office or leading a baseball team, right? Like no one likes that micromanaging style at all. You've got to delegate.
That's a little bit what's happening with Kapler is that the players feel micromanaged, right?
Yeah.
The players feel like, you know, you're going to slot me in for, you know, two innings in the middle of the game. I'm a starting pitcher, you know, what happened? You signed me for 3 years. I'm a starting right fielder. You know, like why am I, you know, not playing today against against a left-hander or like, you know what I mean? Like there's all these, you know, machinations that, you know, players just don't know what their roles are. I could see that being in order for that to work. You really like that's happened before with the A's where people didn't know what their roles were, but Melvin, I think I heard one or two players in the time that Melvin's with the A's that were like, you know, I don't know what my role is, you know? So that's a real testament to Melvin's ability to communicate.
Totally. And I think losing brings that out too. Both these teams are winning. You kind of overlook some of this stuff, right? There's that old big sage, you know, quote you often hear that winning cures everything. And it does, right? That the problems weren't fixed last year when the Padres were good, right? It's just, they're not good this year. So everything's going to spill out into the open. So it's fascinating when you look at it. And as I said, the Padres kind of clinging on in that NL wildcard race, but you know, over on the AL side, we've got some movement here since we last recorded. It was more of like a log jam. And now we are seeing Texas has had a terrific week. Seattle really stumbled playing Texas. They really struggled. They were out pitched. They're out hit. You know, you kind of look like now we've got the Astros, and we've got the Mariners, and it looks like one of those teams is going to be the wild card team. Obviously, the Tampa Bay Rays are going to be a wild card team. They celebrated last night because the Orioles magic number, as we record this on Thursday, is 1. So the Rays are like, well, we can't hold out for a division celebration. So they just celebrated last night because they're off today. They can all be hungover. Actually, a really good idea.
That's really funny. They're just like preemptively, okay, fine. We'll celebrate
like,
now.
Right. You know, all right, fine. We're not going to win the division. Like, yeah, let's do this before the off day, which I thought was kind of nice. You know, they get to celebrate making the playoffs 5 years in a row. Tremendous accomplishment to everyone involved in that Tampa Bay organization, given the payroll and the constraints they work with in that small market and all the injuries they had this year that we've detailed so many times on this podcast. But you look at it, Eno, and this isn't the Houston team that we're used to seeing. And for
they
Seattle,
they got swept by the Royals, man. That was crazy.
Yes. And then for Seattle, it's like they either look unbeatable or like they'll never win a game again every time I watch them. There's no in between.
It must be heartbreaking. It must be so hard to be a Seattle fan. I mean, they're one of the few teams that hasn't made the World Series and they've been improving. And every year you could be like, oh, this and this is good. We're getting better. We're getting better. But they just can't make that hump. In August, they look like the best team in baseball. And now they had this tough series against the Astros where the Astros just looked like they you know, had better starting pitching for the most part, you know, better hitting in terms of being spread across the lineup, you know, there are more holes, I think, in the Seattle lineup. And so, you know, the Mariners are now the ones that are on the outside. They've got the smallest odds. At the same time, I can't count them out. I mean, Julio Rodriguez was so hot, and that staff is, I think, one of the top three staffs in baseball in Seattle. So just a weird bad blood between the Astros and Mariners. They are some teams that are really tired of each other. There was a lot of chirping about being hit, and then Hector Neris was sort of celebrating in Julio Rodriguez's face. And you know, I think a lot of teams don't like the Astros, but the Astros and Mariners in particular are glad to see each other go in different directions. But the tough thing for the Mariners is they pull the Rangers for the end, while the Astros, I think, get the D-backs. D-backs are a good team, but the Rangers are a better team. And so,
yep.
You know, the Seattle's going to have to overcome some odds here to make it to the postseason. That, I think, probably has the most juice in baseball. The only other, you know, the decision is Astros or Mariners, and then the final NL wild card, the Cubs or the Marlins. Those are the final two races, basically, that are left on the docket for this weekend. To me, there's clear favorites. The Cubs are the better team than the Marlins. I think there's some schedule stuff on both sides on both of these issues. I think the Astros are just slightly better team in that race. Do you see that as the Astros and Cubs being the favorites, or do you have one of the other two teams coming through within the end?
Well, my only thing is, so if you look at it right now, Texas is up 2.5 in the West.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they clinch the West early, and they could, right? Because you look, right? Do those last two games become rest our guys, you know, kind of gimme games? In that case,
like Corey Bradford starts, or they call a guy up from the minors to start, or they you know, they just
like,
they sort of mail it in. They put the hangover lineup in. They do the celebrating with the champagne, and the next day it's all rookies and backups in the lineup.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm trying to look and see what their magic number is, but if that is the case, because they have the head-to-head tiebreaker against the Mariners, the magic number is 2 to clinch the AL West. So as we tape this Thursday, they could clinch by Friday.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Now, if that happens, Seattle may have the upper hand scheduling-wise, right?
Mm-hmm. And the D-backs, on the other hand, are playing for their lives. I mean, they are one ahead of the Cubs, but it's not like they're a lot of the ahead of the Cubs. If the D-backs lost, you know, three of the next four, they might not be in the playoffs. So they're not necessarily going to play the hangover lineup. They're not necessarily going to just put teams out. You know, they're going to try and win each of these games and make it in. So there is something to that.
Yeah. Not as hard as you would think if Texas clinches early. And that really depends now, because they're playing Seattle. They could win the first game and that really
which is also
matter.
Not great mostly, for Seattle.
But yeah, it's mostly Houston. So if Houston loses, Texas wins, Texas clinches the West. Now there's three games left, and Seattle could take those three games.
Yeah.
So this could be a little closer than we think, because Texas may say, well, shit, we're in. Let's rest our starters, right? And so I think it could be.
What if Texas prefers seeing one team or the other, too? You know, if they're like, yeah. Hey, we're in the playoffs and we'd rather not run into the Astros again. So, you know, let's let the Mariners in the back door.
Yeah. Well, because you know there's going to be a hangover game, right? Say they
clinch
that
one, you almost always lose. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. It could be a little bit more interesting than we think. I agree with you. I think the Cubs are a better team than the Marlins. I also think there's a lot more pressure on the Cubs. A lot more panic. They had it locked up. Then they had this huge slide. Now they have like the front office
really
and the president
defensive
talking
plays
about
in the last couple of games that were just like, oh no, if we don't make the playoffs, that was the play that we're all
that
gonna
was
remember.
It. Exactly. And so now you have like bit high ranking members of the Cubs organization addressing this that's going on, this like spiral. Meanwhile, the Marlins are like, well, no one expected us to be here. We don't get a lot of attention, right? Like, could they sneak in? Maybe. Wouldn't surprise me. Like, there are some, a lot of things.
Who's even starting for them?
Right. There are a lot of things that hurt the
Marlins. Really hurt.
Number one, their best pitcher is hurt and out for the season.
I do like Edward Cabrera a lot. I mean, he's wild, but I think he's got great stuff. And then Jesus Luzardo is capable. So, they just threw Braxton Garrett, and they were really mad about the Mets not putting the tarp out. And part of that is because Braxton Garrett could have pitched the final game of the season on regular rest if he'd gone regularly on Monday. But he was forced to go in a doubleheader because they didn't have the tarp on the field during the weekend when it was raining. And so they couldn't recover the field in time for Monday. The quotes from both sides are like sort of clear to be like, I'm not mad at the Mets. I'm basically mad at the Mets ground crew.
Yeah. Well, it's borderline malpractice, honestly.
Everyone knew it was going to rain through the weekend. It was a tropical storm. I mean, the tarp should have been out all weekend. So,
I know. And then once it starts raining, doesn't someone say, let's go put the tarp on?
Well, I guess they said that at some point they put the tarp on over rain. So, there was some sogginess underneath that didn't dry off. So there is like, you have to take the tarp off to let it dry. If you put the tarp on over water, it's going to be muggy underneath. I don't know. I'm not actually on a grounds crew. And so I don't love putting the grounds crew to test like this. They know a lot more about it than I do. But at the same time,
don't they follow orders?
Yeah, right.
I don't want to put this on the grounds crew. Shouldn't someone in the Mets like high up and like, let's tarp it, it's gonna rain,
right?
Or MLB, or you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm blaming the poor guy who's rolling the tarp out. Like, come on. But it was, if I was a Marlins fan, they had every right to be angry.
Yeah,
that was an entirely avoidable situation.
And the result for the Marlins is they don't get Braxton Garrett again. They have to find somebody else to pitch other than Edward Cabrera and Jesus Luzardo. But just having Edward Cabrera and Jesus Luzardo ready to go gives them, probably the advantage in two out of those three games. So I think the playoff odds actually favor the Marlins by a hair. What do we have? Fangraphs has Marlins 69%, Cubs 30%. So,
they play Pittsburgh.
They play Pittsburgh and the Cubs. So yeah, they have they're playing a 474 team and the Cubs are playing a 547 team. So who are they playing? Who's 547?
Let me see. Cubs are playing.
Who are they playing? It's not the Astros. Who are the Cubs playing here? Cubs schedule.
My schedule thing won't load. I don't know.
Yeah, I got it. Braves. No. Nope.
Oh.
Brewers.
Oh.
They just finished. They had one more of the Braves today, and then they finished the Brewers. Brewers could be setting stuff up. Like, if you have Woodruff or Burns or Peralta, do you necessarily pitch them in that last series?
Yeah.
So you can say that the regular season winning percentage is this, and the Brewers are this good. However, the Brewers are just setting up. And also, would you throw Peralta or Burns or Woodruff against the Cubs And then throw them against the Cubs again, like 2 days later in the divisional series, in the wild card series. You know, that's how it's going to line up. If the Cubs make the wild card, you see them again. So there's a really interesting thing. It's like, do the Brewers want to knock the Cubs out of the playoffs by showing their best pitchers? Or what happens if the Cubs win enough, make it to the playoffs, and then they've just seen Burnes, Woodruff, and Peralta, and you've used them? So the Brewers have a lot of questions to answer. And, you know, this is why looking at full season numbers and being like, you know, oh, you know, the Cubs are facing this good of a team. We've talked about this a couple of different ways. Yeah. Now. Like, you don't know what lineup the Rangers are going to put out there. You don't know what, pitchers you're going to see in the final 3 days. So really could go either way.
Yeah. Speaking of the Brewers, they're kind of my pick for, and I want to get your opinion on this, a sneaky team that could do better than we expect in the playoffs. So obviously Atlanta Braves are probably the only team off the table here. I think a lot of people just have them penciled in all the way to the World Series. I like the Brewers, you know, for a couple reasons, to overperform, because I think when you look at teams, pitching and defense matters in the playoffs. Their defense, no matter what you look at, several different statistics, is the best. They're the best team, playoff team, defensively. Also, that pitching staff, you look at it, you've got Woodruff, you've got Corbin Burnes, you've got Freddie Peralta, you've got Wade Miley's probably going to go into the bullpen for the DS, and their bullpen is really good. So their offense is always an issue. It is always like a, can they be good enough to not be a liability? And if you look at what their offense has been doing, they have been doing enough. That's going to come down to, in my opinion, still, if the lineup can kind of hold serve so they don't lose games 1-0. But I do think the Brewers could be a team that at least gets out of the DS and could go a little bit farther than people expect. Do you have a team that you feel like, hey, you know, this is a sneaky good team here in the playoffs?
Well, I have one piece I wanted to throw people towards. There's an interesting piece by Dan Zimborski on Fangraphs, the which teams are best built for postseason success. And one thing that he did was kind of shrink the rosters to just the players that will play in the playoffs, which I think is something that might resonate with you, having covered those Nationals where, you know, they had a bad bullpen going in, but they just shrunk their roster and were like, yeah, we're not going to use those guys. So when he did that, the best teams in terms of playoff roster strength were the Braves, not too much of a surprise, Houston Astros second, little bit of a surprise if you shrink that roster, you get a lot better. The Dodgers third, not a surprise. But then the Mariners fourth. So I wanted to highlight that. The Phillies then are next in a sort of three-way tie. I wanted to highlight the Phillies because I'm not sure that projections are going to or that even thinning that roster is going to be that great for them, because I think they might have the best bullpen in this postseason. One of the reasons that I think that is not just Craig Kimbrel or Sir Anthony Dominguez or Soto or Alvarado, but also Jeff Hoffman, who, you know, used to be a bad starter, but rediscovered a new slider in Philadelphia and has been nasty out of the bullpen. Matt Strom is pretty nasty. And then they have this guy, Orion Kerkering, who throws 100 and has an 89-mile-an-hour two-plane slider, and nobody has seen him because he just tore through the minor leagues and he's pitched 2 innings in the big leagues this year. So that bullpen, to me, goes 6 deep. So if you can take, you know, Taiwan Walker out in the second inning, or if you can get 4 innings from Wheeler or 5 from Nola and feel like we've got nastiness after nastiness from left and right coming out of the bullpen, that shortens the game. And we're talking about strikeouts, and that takes some of the pressure off of the bad Phillies defense. I mean, it is a bad Phillies defense, and there's no way you can cut it. Nick Castellanos and Kyle Schwarber in left and right might be the worst defensive outfield pairing in baseball. But you can put one of those guys at DH some games, and you can rely on the pitching staff to strike out a bunch of guys. They've improved the infield defense over time. And with Johan Rojas and Brandon Marsh out there, the outfield defense can be a little bit better. This team is good. This team is really good. And it gets lost because they're not a division winner. They don't have the best offense of all time. They don't have the best starting staff in the playoffs. They might have the best bullpen in the playoffs. this is a team that can go to the World Series, and this is a team that can win it. So I'm going to throw the Phillies out there as a team that could get there, and people aren't talking about it enough, I think.
That's a good one. I also struggle to believe there's a more clutch hitter than Bryce Harper right now, right? Like, the guy just dials it up. It's incredible to watch. And you know he's going to dial it up this year for the playoffs like he did last year. So I don't, you know, there's no tangible way to put that into a sheet somewhere, except that's like the last guy on the planet you want to face in a big spot in October. So I like that. It's so funny because remember for years and years, the Phillies bullpen was just like the subject of ire. Just it felt like for several seasons, it was like, oh God, hang on, here comes the bullpen. And to have such a strong bullpen heading into October, like you said, it's a game changer. It's going to be so interesting to see how they deploy that bullpen and how they, you know, how they maneuver. And you're right, the Braves have kind of dwarfed everyone else in the National League. It feels like we're just talking about the Braves and everybody else. But you know, the Braves have some holes here. Charlie Morton is hurt. They're dealing with some pitching issues. Morton's not going to be available. And then they also had an issue with Fried and the blister, and that he is going to be available for the playoffs.
Maybe the first series. So for their first series, I think they're down Morton and Fried, which means some Bryce Elder, who I don't think is that great. And
Strider.
It's going to be a lot on Strider winning his game and then finding their way through with their bullpen, which is their bullpen is good. And then also slugging. They're going to slug their way through it. But the Dodgers also have their issues where Bobby Miller is going to be starting game one or game two. And so, you know, there's some issues there with both of the top teams. So I think the Phillies could get through. A note on clutch real quick. This has been a thing that I think is super interesting, that stats have not, I want to be careful here. Stats have not been able to prove clutch exists. That does not mean clutch doesn't exist. And, you know, I've talked to people like I was talking to Brett Phillips, and he's like, if you could put a heart monitor on us while we're at the plate, you'd tell that some people were stressed out more than others. And some people just have a low heart rate when they're up there. We do have a stat that looks at who does better in clutch situations. It's called clutch. It's on Fangraphs. Bryce Harper is number two in baseball this year behind, of all people, Ezekiel Tovar. But he's definitely been second most clutch this year. The reason why people say, you know, we're not sure clutch exists is that, you know, season to season, he's clutch this year. People aren't as clutch the next year. So if I do like a 3-year search for the most clutch people in baseball, Harper does not show up on the first page, weirdly. But yes, I agree. I think he's super clutch. So I think that there's something there in terms of the research that they're missing something, or they're not measuring the right thing necessarily. They're just looking at these small sample results. I mean, if you look at the last 3 years, the most clutch players in baseball, nobody would ever guess this. Tommy Edmond is number one over the last three seasons. Harold Castro is number two. Chaz McCormick, Jock Peterson, Carlos Santana. It's a weird group of people.
Yeah, so. I think it's very subjective. Like, what is clutch? Clutch to me, to find, might be different than you, right? Like, and also, do you get bonus points for the game, like stakes, regular season, different level of clutch than the World Series, right? Elimination game, different level of clutch than game one in a 7-game set, right? So I think that should be baked in. It's just a very complex thing.
And like postseason numbers are never in these. Because it's unfair to put postseason numbers in, because some people are just not in the postseason, right? Sure. Yeah. So, you know, and then those postseason numbers are small samples. So that's why postseason numbers aren't in there. But I would have to figure that if you put postseason numbers in, Harper would do better. So, you know, it's something that people yell at stat people about. I understand it. I think that there's a definite possibility that clutch exists. The other thing that I would say is it's a possibility that all these players are clutch to some extent, because if you're not clutch in college, you know, if you're not performing in big games in college, do you get drafted? And if you are in the minors and you're not clutch and you can't perform in big moments, do you get, you know, get moved up? When you look at players in the big leagues, they're not part of a bell curve. They're already all the guys all the way out here. They're already the best of the best of the best. So maybe they're all pretty much clutch. And, you know, maybe there's not that much of a difference between Tommy Edman and Bryce Harper. And, you know, let me just do the other side. Let me do unclutch over the last 3 years. The least clutch over the last 3 years. Oh, my God.
Who is
it? No way. Paul Goldschmidt, number one. Marcus Simeon, number two.
I wish we had more time in the season for someone to just find Paul Goldschmidt. Be like, what do you think of being the most
unplugged player? Juan Soto, number three. Cal Raleigh, number four. Cal Raleigh had one of the biggest home runs in Seattle history. And number five is Will Smith. Number six is Austin Riley. It's so weird. Like, I just, it never lines up with what you think. So I mostly don't cite that stat because, you know, I don't get it. It doesn't line up with what people think. But I just agree subjectively that Bryce Harper is clutch. So that's part of the reason I'll put the Phillies on my dark horse list.
Yeah. Well, speaking of clutch, we're going to get to see a whole new stage of that by the time we tape this again next week. The ALDS will be going on. The wild card will, I guess, be, well, the ALDS won't be going on. The wild cards will have started.
Yeah.
I'm getting my weeks wrong. That October 7th is when we really get into the DS. Yes. We'll kind of know what's going on. We may have a series over. We certainly have a lot to digest to talk about, how the season ended for some of these teams. Who's in, who's out, who's going home.
We'll have some final day firings of managers. You know,
yes, lots of stuff. There's going to be a lot of stuff going on. So we will see you back here. Not sure of our exact playoff schedule yet, but you will see us in your feed at some point in time. We may adjust depending on these games and what's going on. But it was great, as usual, talk baseball with you, Eno. Derek Van Riper will be back with us in just a couple weeks. I'm Britt Giroli. He's Eno Saris. You can follow us on Twitter at Eno Saris, at Britt_Giroli. If you don't already, you can read our stuff on The Athletic. There's always a deal going on. I think right now it's $2 introductory for the first year per month. You can read Ken Rosenthal, Jason Stark, just the whole all-star of writers there at The Athletic. So check it out. Give us a rating, review, shout on Twitter, and please read the fantastic piece on Eno Saris. Take care of yourself, guys. Have a great rest of your week, and we will see you back here next weekend.
Thanks, Good Beer Hunting. Thanks, Brian Roth. And you always got the green light here.
Green light 3-0, and she's gone!
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.